From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, our Jazz Week continues with saxophonist James Moody. He'll talk about the evolution of the song Moody's Mood for Love and his years with Dizzy Gillespie's band. Marian McPartland will describe the jazz life from her perspective as one of the few women instrumentalists of her generation who made it in the world of jazz. And singer Annie Ross, who was part of the trio Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, will talk about writing the lyric Twisted. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan chooses the best books of the year 2000. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect George W. Bush is bringing back a former defense secretary to head the Pentagon. Bush named Donald Rumsfeld to take charge of the Defense Department. Rumsfeld, who's 68, has served in four previous Republican administrations, beginning in the Nixon White House. He was Secretary of Defense in the Ford administration after serving as President Ford's White House Chief of Staff. Rumsfeld's appointment came as a surprise. Until just recently, former Indiana Senator Dan Coats was considered the leading candidate for the job. Bush told reporters that he hopes to have his cabinet completed at the end of the first week in January. He's expected to announce at least one other appointment tomorrow. The latest census numbers show that 8 states will pick up congressional seats. 10 states will lose them. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The Census Bureau says more than 281 million people lived in the United States this year. That's a 13.2% increase over 1990, when the last census was conducted. Most of the growth took place in the South and the West. As a result, Arizona, Texas, Georgia, and Florida will each pick up 2 congressional seats. California, Nevada, Colorado, and North Carolina will each pick up 1. The losers are mostly in the Northeast. Pennsylvania and New York are set to lose 2 congressional seats each. Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, and Indiana will each lose 1. So will Ohio, Connecticut, Oklahoma, and Mississippi. More detailed census data will be released early next year. States will use that information when they redraw their congressional districts. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge in Denver has granted Timothy McVeigh's request to end his appeals. The Oklahoma City bomber made the decision against the advice of his attorneys. Colorado Public Radio's Dan Dreher has more from Denver.
Judge Richard Meich told McVeigh that he could change his mind between now and January 11th, but if McVeigh sticks with his decision, a date for his execution would be set. The convicted bomber gave no reason for ending appeals. Until recently, he had argued vigorously for new trials. McVeigh wasn't in the courtroom. He appeared on closed-circuit television from a federal prison in Indiana. He told the judge that he would submit to a psychological evaluation to determine if he's competent to make this decision. McVeigh says he may ask for clemency from the president. If McVeigh is put to death, it would be the first federal execution in the United States in more than 35 years. For NPR News, I'm Dan Dreher in Denver.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 66 points to close at 10,869 in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 1 billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 18 points to close at 2,558. For the year to date, the NASDAQ is off 37%. This is NPR. The Texas State Senate has named Senator Bill Ratliff to serve as the state's new lieutenant governor. Ratliff will fill the place of former Lieutenant Governor Rick Perry, who moved up to governor after the resignation of George W. Bush. The Senate made its choice in a secret ballot after the Texas Supreme Court overruled a lower court that said the vote had to be public. A number of Texas news organizations had sued, saying the secret vote was a violation of the state's Open Meetings Act. The flu is arriving late this season, but there are signs that it's on its way. NPR's John Hamilton has more.
A shortage of flu vaccine in October and November had public health officials hoping for a late flu season. They got their wish. Nationwide, there have been fewer cases than there were at this time last year. But figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show the flu has arrived in Texas and is increasing in Arkansas, Colorado, Georgia, Kentucky, Maryland, and Tennessee. Tests show that this year's flu vaccine should be effective against the strain seen so far, so health officials are urging people who haven't already done so to get flu shots, which are now widely available. Flu is most dangerous to people who are older than 65, younger than 6 months, or have health problems. The CDC estimates that vaccinating an additional million elderly people could prevent 900 deaths and 1,300 hospitalizations. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
President Clinton said today that the federal surplus is expected to reach $1.9 trillion over the next 10 years. That's $300 billion higher than last summer's estimate. The president said the new estimates mean that the United States could pay off all its publicly held debt in less than a decade. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Florence and John Schumann Foundation for support of independent, non-commercial public affairs reporting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air. We're featuring interviews with musicians and singers who have made significant contributions to the development of jazz. Saxophonist James Moody first became known for his 1949 recording of I'm in the Mood for Love. His reworking of the melody was so good, it became the melody of a new song with a lyric by Eddie Jefferson called Moody's Mood for Love. Here's Moody's 1949 recording. James Moody began his career in 1947 in the early days of bebop, playing with Dizzy Gillespie's big band. By the end of the 40s, he'd left the band and moved to Europe. Moody returned to the States in the early 50s to lead his own band. He played with Gillespie again during much of the 60s, but in the 70s, Moody left the jazz scene to work a steady job in a Vegas hotel band. When he returned to the jazz world, critic Gary Giddens wrote that there are few living musicians he enjoys hearing in performance more than Moody. I spoke with Moody in 1996 after the release of his recording of songs associated with Frank Sinatra. Here's Moody singing on the title track, Young at Heart.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind. If you're young at heart, you can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart.
James Moody, welcome to Fresh Air. And I want to say that I think this new album is delightful, and it's really delightful to hear you sing and to sing a song that's not a novelty song. Are you singing more now?
Well, maybe this might be the beginning of something. You know, maybe, who knows? You know, when you have strings like that, it makes you think you can sing, you know.
What do you think of your voice?
Well, it's a funny thing is I'm not as concerned with my voice as I am with my lisp. that I have, you know, because I'm partially deaf. And I was born that way, and it doesn't mean that I have a speech impediment. It's just that I don't hear S's. So because my wife always tells me when I'm singing Mood for Love, I'd say, you give me a smile, and it says, it sounds like you're saying you give me a mile when I'm wrapped up in your magic, you know, in the lyrics. So anyway, that, you know, but I guess at this stage of the game, I just say what I say and hope that it comes out.
Well, has that held you back from singing? Are you self-conscious about that lesson?
No, really not at all, because I say what I say. I've been doing it for 71 years of talking, so if I say, you know, fairy tales can come true, you know, I don't know, too, you know, it can happen to you if you're young at heart. Doodle-dee-doo-doo-doo-wee-dee.
Oh, I love that. Now, are there tones that you can't hear musically in an instrument?
Well, I don't know. I don't know because I can't. I don't know what I don't hear. Does that make sense to you?
No, I know what you're saying. I want to ask you a little bit more about your hearing. How old were you when you realized you had a hearing problem?
I was born that way, and I never realized it. I still haven't realized it because I hear what I hear, and that's it. See, if you don't know what you're missing, how can you say what you miss?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There was insistence that that I wear a hearing aid because I would hear so much better. And I put this hearing aid on, and I'm telling you, I thought I was going to go nuts with the clanging and banging that I heard, you know, banging, clack, clack, boom. And you could hear the tires of the car. Blah, 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 blah. I says, oh, my goodness, if people hear this, I mean, it's nerve-wracking. So what I did was I turned it off, and they said, well, isn't that much better? I said, it certainly is. Yeah.
So you've intentionally not worn a hearing aid.
Oh, no. And there's nothing that can be done, like no surgery or anything. So, like, what I do is, like, what did they say, honey? What did they say? Honey, what was that? What was that? My wife, my honey Linda, boy, she tells me, you know, whatever it is, if I feel that I've missed something. You heard that joke, didn't you, Terry, about the guy says, oh, man, he says, boy, I just spent $4,000 on this wonderful hearing aid, you know. And the guy said, yeah. Says, what kind is it? The guy said, it's 12 o'clock.
It took me a second.
Yeah.
Right. So did music sound different with the hearing aid?
Oh, I wouldn't dare do that. I wouldn't dare put a hearing aid on and play music because just the way I hear it, that's the way I hear it. Because if I put the hearing aid in, then it's banging and clanging again,
mm-hmm.
and clinking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell us the story of the band that you played in the Air Force, and this was right after you got out of college.
Well, the band that I played in the Air Force was an unauthorized Air Force band because when I was in the Air Force, it was segregated. So 3/4 of the base was Caucasian and 1/4 was Negro. And they wanted to have a Negro band, so they formed one. And then Linton Garner, Earl Garner's brother, he was drafted and he came to the base where we were. And then Pop Reeves, he was drafted, and he wrote some things for Benny Goodman. And I never will forget Linton Garner. One day he asked me, he said, Moody, he said, play your scales for me. So I said, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he said, well? I said, well, what? He said, is that it? I said, yeah. He said, my boy, you're in for a rude awakening. You know, so anyway, but little by little. But, you know, I'd like to say one thing, Terry. When I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, I was 18 years old, right? And I was living in Newark, New Jersey. Do you know that the German prisoners of war used to come into town and jump off the truck, you know, with the PW on their back and those hats, and go into the restaurant and eat, and we couldn't?
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you feel about serving in the Air Force, knowing that your own country wouldn't let you into certain restaurants?
Well, what could you do? You see, because in the first place, like, there was nothing you could. After I left and went to Europe and was living in France, I would send my wife, I would send my mother a letter, and I'd have on there, it had the land of the brave, I'd put the land of the au fait, you know, or something, USA, you know. And my mother said, Jim, don't do that. I mean, you get in trouble, you know. But, hey, it was the truth, you know, because, like it was their land, you know, not mine.
You joined the Gillespie Big Band after you got out of the Air Force.
Yeah.
And it was a very innovative band. It was one of the first big bands really playing the new music of bebop. What was it like for you to be in this band? What were the most exciting parts of it for you?
Well, the most exciting thing about that band was that when I grew older and found out where I was when I first was in that band, because, like I've said before, when I joined the band, Thelonious Monk was the piano player, Ray Brown was the bass player, Milt Jackson was the vibe harpist, and Kenny Klugemop-Clark, he was the drummer. That was the rhythm section, along with Howard Johnson, Cecil Payne, all the people like that. Now, if I would have known where I was, like, I would have fainted, you see?
Sure.
So I'm glad I was naive. I wasn't that hip, so I didn't know where I was. I mean, I knew, but I didn't. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh.
And what was Dizzy Gillespie like as a band leader? I think you've called him your musical father.
Oh, yeah, Diz was wonderful, man. Then we knew each other and it was all right, you know, but I got to really know him better when I played in the quintet, you know, and, musically, he was bad, boy. He was bad. And Diz was always studying, too. Like, he would always, you know, he'd sit down at the piano, look at this, look at that, look at this. And he saw me, he said, Moody, this is where everything is. See the piano? I don't care what the instrument is. That's where it is. The trombone, violin, trumpet, saxophone, flute. This is where it is. You look at it, you see everything. When you play the piano, all the notes are laid out there for you. You know, and all those notes are on every one of the instruments. So Diz said, you want to really know what's happening, you learn the piano. You know.
Did you?
Yeah, that's what he did. Pardon me?
Did you learn it?
Well, I can play the changes, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I can sit down and I can pick out what I have to do. You know, before I used to have to call a friend, hey, could you play the changes for me so I can hear what they sound like? You know, but I don't have to do that. I can play them myself now.
My guest is saxophonist James Moody. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's Jazz Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1996 interview with saxophonist James Moody.
Your first solo was recorded with the Dizzy Gillespie Band. The tune is called Eminon, which is no name spelled backwards.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I think, in 1947. Do you remember your solo on that record? Could you sing
it? Yeah, I remember it. Yeah, I remembered it because I wasn't supposed to take the solo. The baritone player was supposed to take it, and he didn't show up or something. And the solo with something like that.
And now, how come you remember it? Do you remember it from actually playing it or from listening to the record?
No, because a lot of times when we see each other, like sometimes I'm talking to Jimmy Heath, it's section we call each other because he's a wonderful saxophonist. Or some of the guys, and we're talking, somebody said, oh, yeah, man, you remember Eminon when we were Dizzy? Yeah. And we'd all sing it for a moment together, you know.
Thank you.
Now, the most famous solo that you've ever taken was on your first recording of I'm in the Mood for Love. And then Eddie Jefferson, a singer who was working with you, wrote a lyric to your solo, and that became the song known as Moody's Mood for Love. Let's hear the Eddie Jefferson version of Moody's Mood for Love, his lyric to your solo.
There I go, there I go, there I go, there I go. Pretty baby, you are the soul that snaps my control. Such a funny thing, but every time you're near me, I never can behave. You give me a smile and then I'm wrapped up in your magic. There's music all around me, crazy music, music that keeps calling me so very close to you, turns me your slave. Come and do with me any little thing you want to. Anything, baby, just let me get next to you. Am I insane or do I really see heaven in your eyes? Bright as stars that shine up above there in the clear blue sky. How I worry about you, just can't live my life without you, baby. Come here, don't have no fear. Oh, is there wonder why I'm really feeling in the mood for love? And tell me why.
Now, what impact did Moody's Mood for Love have on your career?
Well, if I don't do it to this day, people said I haven't been there. I mean, that goes to show you. Like, no matter how much I practiced, if I don't say, there I go, or play, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, then it's like I haven't been there. But, like, I'm not, it doesn't make me feel like, oh, I don't want to be doing this. But, I mean, I love doing it. And it's been very good to me, that that solo. And I'm honored and privileged, I believe, you know, to be able to do it.
Now, I want to take a pause here and play something that's basically an outtake. But it's such an entertaining outtake. And this is this was something you recorded in 1958. The tune is called The Moody One. And you stopped.
I goofed.
Yeah.
On the record date.
Well, let's play the outtake and hear the goof.
I goofed on the record date, and they left that in there. Yeah, I remember that.
Here it is. Were your outtakes usually as entertaining as this one?
Oh, sure. That's like the bloopers, you know. That was my blooper. That was my way of doing it, you know. But anybody, when they do something like that, they always say something that's a little comical, you know.
Were you surprised that this actually ended up on the record?
Well, yeah, because, like, you know, finally they said, yeah, we're going to leave it on there, too. I said, what? Yeah, I said, well, go ahead. I don't care. And then I'd go and play places. People says, I goofed on the record date.
I want to ask you something else about Dizzy Gillespie.
Uh-huh.
You were very close with Dizzy Gillespie. Were you close to him when he died?
Yeah. We were with him. I had him in my arms. There was John Faddis was there.
The trumpeter.
Yeah, Jacques Mouyel and his son, John Motley, and myself. Yeah, there were five of us in there with him when he passed. And you know what's funny? I told John, I said, John, you mark my word, 10 years from now, there are going to be 50 people in the room with this. You know, and there was no music playing. There was nothing. I mean, Diz was just sitting there, but, you know, trying to breathe deep, trying to get his breath. and his eyes were closed, you know, he never opened them, and finally he took the last one, man, and that was, you know, so, yep, that was it, man.
Was he conscious toward the end? Did he know that you were there?
Well, the night before he knew that we were there. The night before, because Mike Lungo and myself, we went to see him. And we said, ooh, papa da, you know, zi-a-ba-dee-ba-be. And he tried to mouth, ooh, papa da. And then the thing he did was he took his finger and put it up to his lips and tried to make his jaws go out like he usually did. You know how he would do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he was too weak, but we smiled, you know, and all like that. And I said, Mikkel, let's go, man. We'll come back tomorrow. I said that to Mike Lungo, you know. And so, you know, then when I went back the next day, like, he was in bed that night. And then when I went back the next day, he was sitting up. They had him in a chair sitting up. And he was, you know, trying to breathe. So anyway, it's not the same. Nothing is the same anymore without Diz, man. You know?
You must feel like you owe so much of your career to him because he gave you your first job and then you played with him off and on for so long.
Yeah, he did when I was 21 years old. First gig. Yep. Yep. And even now, like I tell people, that when they asked me, they said, well, what do you remember of this? You know, I mean, there are many things, and what happened is sometimes I'll say, that's what he meant. You know, it might be because everywhere that I've gone in the world, no matter where it was, I was there first with this. This took me everywhere first, man. You know, I go to Africa, you know, just Sweden, Germany, France, all except Paris. I went there first alone, but then after that, everywhere else was with this. And now, when I go to those places, and I'm going, boy, I say, oh man, you know. And for the longest time, I used to call my wife. I used to call Linda, my honey, and tell her, says, honey, I called you and you weren't home. You know, she says, honey, I've been home all day. I said, well, I said, but I called, and then I'd say the number, and she'd say, honey, that Dizzy's number.
Oh, wow. Yeah. James Moody recorded in 1996. Here he is with Dizzy Gillespie's band. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Eddie Bauer, supporting radio expeditions and offering outdoor-inspired clothing, accessories, and home furnishings in stores, catalogs, and at eddiebauer.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, our Jazz Week continues with pianist Marian McPartland, one of the few women instrumentalists of her generation who made it in the world of jazz, and Annie Ross, who was part of the trio Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, which helped popularize vocalese. Also, critic Maureen Carrigan chooses the best books of the year.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Jazz Week on our show. Pianist Marion McPartland is one of the few women instrumentalists of her generation who made it in the world of jazz. She's now in her early 80s. She's made her mark not only as a musician, but as the host of the NPR series Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz. If there is such a thing as the jazz life, McPartland's background was not the perfect preparation for it. She grew up in England in a proper upper-middle-class home where classical music was appreciated while jazz was heartily disapproved of. She moved to America after marrying Chicago cornetist Jimmy McPartland. They met during World War II while they were each performing for the troops. For the first few years of her 20-year marriage, she played Dixieland standards with her husband. But since the early 50s, she led her own small groups, playing more modern music. Jimmy McPartland died in March of 1991, a month after he and Marion remarried. Here's Marion McPartland, recorded in 1953 at the 52nd Street Club, the Hickory House. I spoke with Marion McPartland in 1987. I'd like to talk with you about your life. So many of your listeners on radio have heard you talk with other musicians about their lives. I want to hear some about yours. I know you came from a pretty proper family in England. Your mother played classical music and I think wished that you played classical music too. They didn't like the idea of you playing jazz. What did it represent to your parents?
Oh, I think my mother said, what was it? Oh, you'll come to no good. You'll marry a musician and live in an attic. See, that's pretty much what happened. Although we weren't ever in the attic, but we were in some funny little apartments. But that was her idea, that I would meet terrible people and that I would come to no good, you know, that it represented something depraved.
Did your teachers in music school feel the same way?
When I finally studied the 3 years that I did take lessons at the Guildhall School of Music, I played by ear up until that time. When I was studying, the professor I had there was a very wonderful guy, very solemn, but very much against jazz. And at that time, I was really into learning all kinds of jazz from records. And I would be supposed to be practicing, but I would be playing something by Art Tatum or trying to perfect an Art Tatum run or something, and he opened the door one time and said, got very red in the face, "Stop playing that trash!" So I'm afraid there's probably still a few people that feel that way, but not as much as they did at that time.
I think your entry into the jazz life came during World War II when you were playing for the troops and playing a lot of jazz. Were you considered something of a freak being a woman jazz musician?
No, I don't think so, Terry. Because when I went to France and played in a group for the armed forces, that really wasn't jazz. That was sort of showbiz again. And then actually after I met Jimmy, I guess that's when I feel that I really got into playing a little more actual jazz. But then when I came here to the States and got to hear all the people in person that I had loved for so long on records, like Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, Art Tatum, Teddy Wilson, all those people, then a lot of it did start to sort of rub off on me, and I became a better player because of hearing all these people, and of course because of Jimmy working with his group.
Well, when you started playing, you were playing with your husband's band.
Yes.
And I wonder if it was hard for you to get your own sense of identity as a performer. I think a lot of women who are married to someone who they work with, especially a few decades ago, were considered the wife of, and kind of secondary to, the man who was performing. Did that ever happen?
It's funny. I guess I must have been naturally pushy or something. Plus the fact that Jimmy was very helpful. He was always very helpful and very admiring of my talent. And he was always introducing me to do solo numbers and to do numbers with the band. He seemed to be very proud of what I did. So he really was the one that kind of sold me on the idea that I should have my own trio. And once I did start with the trio, Jimmy was very helpful in introducing me to all kinds of people.
Jimmy McPartland used to drink a lot.
Yes, he sure did.
Did you ever feel, since you were his wife, when you were playing together on the bandstand, that you had to keep one eye on how much he was drinking?
Oh, Terry, that's a whole other... I mean, if you ever want to do a show on alcoholism and AA, I could talk about that. I mean, Jimmy finally went into AA, and I was probably a terrible person because I was always nagging and worrying about that. It just seems like there's always somebody around, a person who drinks a lot. There's always some sort of well-meaning do-gooder trying to keep them straight, and that was me.
Well, that must have put a real strain on your performing, to on the one hand be playing, and on the other hand trying to keep track of what was happening with your husband.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many anecdotes I could tell about that. At this point, they seem funny, though at the time they weren't, because, you know, when somebody's drinking, they always have a million friends who want to make sure that they buy them drinks and they get their quota. You know, Jimmy would walk around the bar and tell everybody that his wife couldn't stand to see him drink, and so his friends would say, oh, that's terrible. You know, they would carry a water glass full of gin into the men's room, and I never could figure out how he got... Although Jimmy wasn't a sort of a falling down drunk, he just got very slow and boring. You know, and the worst thing that would happen would be he'd be announcing a tune, and it would take him 10 minutes to announce the tune, and we'd all be saying, oh, for God's sake, get on with it, you know. No, that's a whole other side of my life, and it seems to have, in retrospect, as I say, a lot of it seems very funny, though at the time it was quite a tragedy.
Did that have anything to do with your wanting to lead your own trio and getting out of playing with him?
No, I don't think so. Not at that time. I don't think so. I think it was just inside me there was this real, must have been this real determined ambition to get ahead. I'm somebody who, as they say, likes to take care of business, you know,
right.
the phone calls and all the things that are really such an important part of doing a job. You can't be late. And you've got to be well-rehearsed and know what you're doing at all times.
We'll get back to our 1987 interview with pianist Marian McPartland after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1987 interview with pianist Marian McPartland.
You told us a little earlier that you didn't feel that out of place being a woman early on in your jazz career, and I'll tell you, I find that hard to believe.
Well, you see, Terry, before I had gone to America, there were so many women that I had listened to who were my idols, like Hazel Scott, Mary Lou Williams, Lil Armstrong, and a woman who I've really admired a great deal, Cleo Brown, so that I didn't realize that being a woman, when I got to New York, being a woman with a jazz group, people would find it unusual, because it seemed to me that there were plenty of women out there, and I still think so. They would...
You know what might have been helpful to you, too? Being married to a jazz musician. And what I mean by that is that you weren't, quote, available to any man who thinks, well, I think I'll flirt with that dame pianist, you know, because I'm
No, that's true. That's true.
You know,
and then there's this to it also, Terry, that when I did get out with my own trio, I was really in it for the music. Like, although I think I dressed pretty well, you know, cared about my appearance, there wasn't any idea of, well, I'm going to play and I'm going to be winking at some guy at the bar. I wanted so much for the music to be accepted, and I really wanted to play as well as I could, and that's always been in the forefront, you know, to try to play as well as I could. although at that time I think I was rather dependent upon the opinion of other people. I mean, I'm not so much that anymore. I've sort of become my own person a little more than I was then.
Well, speaking of the opinion of other people, I was reading a Newsweek review of your work from December 30th of 1957.
Oh, my God!
And it said that you played, quote, a romantic arrangement of On the Alamo, and then a little later, her style turned masculine and aggressive as she swung into From This Moment On. And I love that because I don't think that they would have called it a romantic arrangement if it was a man playing a ballad. And then as it was aggressive, it turned masculine. And you must have run into that a lot.
Yeah, it's funny because after a while, that did start to annoy me. And I would think every time that you would get a little stronger or more forceful. They didn't say that. They didn't call it strong or forceful. It was either aggressive or masculine. And so people would say to me, oh, you play just like a man. Or else they'd say, oh, you play good for a girl. And after a while, in the beginning, I sort of took everything as a compliment. But then I would think, well, why does it have to be aggressive? I don't like that word. It just makes me feel so that I'm sort of hunching my shoulders and punching the piano. You know, why does it have to be aggressive? Why can't it just be with more strength or more a more forceful player? So gradually over the years, I think all that stuff has changed. I've noticed nobody says that anymore.
Right. You know, your career has had an interesting graph to it. A lot of musicians start their careers, well, early on in their lives, become very well known for a certain style, for a certain recording, and then they reach a peak early on, and it's kind of, in the public eye, it's kind of downhill from there. And I think with your career, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been this slow, upward...
It's amazing,
rise, and every year you become better known, and I think your playing becomes more beautiful, and I think it's an unusual twist on the typical career.
It's funny. I think... Well, I just feel as if everything I've done has been a sort of a springboard to do something else. And I like to set goals for myself and always have something new to do. And I also have this feeling that one, you're supposed to improve as you learn more, you're supposed to get better. I feel as if I know more. Therefore, I should be able to play more. And I'm always trying to eliminate bad things about my playing. And it's just that feeling. I think, well, you should be able to do better. You should be able to play better. You should be able to write more. And so far, I've been lucky. That's the way it's gone.
This also brings to mind a very nice quote from Mary Lou Williams that's in one of the profiles in your new book. And she says, anything you are shows up in your music.
Yeah, isn't that a great thing?
I do like that quote a lot. It seems to me that cuts both ways, though.
probably
the wisdom of your life is reflected in your music. But if you're really in a real rut emotionally, that could come out in your music, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it could. I mean, I don't want to drop any names, but I can think of some people years ago that I felt that about, that they would reach a certain level. And I guess the temptation is, if you're very well known, is to reach a certain level and then coast on what you had. And you sort of think, well, I don't have to do any better. But I think maybe that's the way I've always been brought up, that you're supposed to always do your best and try hard and don't give up. And there's this saying about, I forget who said this, but that when you sit down to play, you should play as if it were the last day of your life. Play as well as you can, because it may be the last chance you have to play. And I think a lot of us do feel that way.
Pianist Marion McPartland, recorded in 1987. Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, the vocal trio of Dave Lambert, John Hendricks, and Annie Ross, was perhaps the most popular jazz vocal group of the late 50s and early 60s. They did vocalese, that is, their songs put words to jazz instrumental arrangements and improvisations. Annie Ross left the trio in 1962 and has since recorded on her own and acted on stage and screen. The song Annie Ross is best known for is Twisted. She wrote her lyric to a melody and improvisation by tenor saxophonist Wardell Gray. Twisted has been recorded by Bette Midler and Joni Mitchell. This is Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross.
My analyst told me that I was right out of my head the way he described it.
How?
He said I'd be better dead than live. I didn't listen to his jive. I knew all along he was all wrong, and I knew that he thought
what?
I was crazy, but I'm not. Oh no.
Oh no.
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head. He said I need treatment,
yeah.
But I'm not that easily led. He said I was the type that was most inclined, went out of his sight, to be out of my mind. And he thought I was nuts,
nuts.
No more ifs, or ands, or buts. Oh no.
Oh no.
Oh no.
They say as a child I appeared a little bit wild with all my crazy ideas, but I knew what was happening. I knew I was a genius. What's so strange when you know that you're a wizard at three? I knew that this was meant to be. But I heard little children were supposed to sing tight. That's why I left with the vodka one night. My parents got frantic, didn't know what to do. But I saw some crazy scenes before I came to. Now, do you think I was crazy? I may have been only three, but I was swinging. They all have been angry and bad. They all have been absent, and also an Einstein. So why should I feel sorry if they just couldn't understand the reason the and the logic that went on in my head? I had a brain, it was a pain, though, to let them have at me when I refused to ride on all the double-decker buses, all because there was no driver on the top.
No driver on the top.
She must be out of her head.
What's the matter with her?
My analyst told me
what?
That I was right out of my head the way you described it.
Annie Ross, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We just heard Twisted.
Yeah.
I just need to ask you if you were in analysis when you wrote that.
No, I was not and have never been. It was really suggested, the title Twisted suggested to me the whole story of a woman going to an analyst. But no, I wasn't in analysis.
How did you start doing vocalese, putting words to jazz solos?
Well, I went to see a man called Bob Weinstock, who had a record label. And we talked, and he said, you know, have you heard Moody's Mood for Love? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, do you think you could do something like that? And I said, sure. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and my necessity was need of money. So I took a stack of records home, played them. The one that I really liked was Twisted. And I was back the next morning with the lyrics.
Let me play a song that you recorded before you teamed up with Lambert and Hendrix. This is from a 1957 session that you made with baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
Mm-hmm.
And the session has recently been reissued. The title is Annie Ross Sings a Song with Mulligan. And I'm going to play the Dietzen Schwartz song, I Guess I'll Have to Change My Plans.
Oh, good.
Well, I guess I have to change my plan. I should have realized I'd lose my favorite man. I overlooked that point completely until the big affair began. Before I knew where I was at, I found myself upon a shelf, and that was that. I tried to reach the moon, but when I got there, all that I could get was the air. My feet are back upon the ground, 'cause I've lost the one man that I found.
You came to America from England when you were, I think, 6 years old.
Scotland,
from Scotland.
5 and a half.
Okay.
No, 4 and a half. I was 4 and a half when I arrived.
Now, once you got to America, didn't you stay there with your aunt, the singer Ella Logan?
Yes, I did. I came to New York with my mother and father and my elder brother, and I won a contest, a radio contest. The prize was a six-month, really a token contract with MGM. And I went out to L.A. with my aunt because my aunt started doing films. And then my mother left, my father and mother and brother all went back, and I was raised in Beverly Hills in L.A.
Did your parents have any reservations about leaving you?
I'm sure they did.
Did they want it that way, or was it you who?
I think they probably felt that it was best for me to do that. That maybe through doing that, I could become a star. But they already had stars.
You mean California already has stars?
Sure, they had Shirley Temple and Jane Withers, and you know, many, many young kids.
Well, how were you groomed? What kind of image were you given?
The Shirley Temple image, but with a kilt.
Oh, because you were Scottish.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I had a thick Scottish accent, too.
Well, that must have been rough.
Oh, I think everybody thought it was adorable.
Did you have those little curls?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Now, you also did some Our Gang comedies?
Oh, I only did one, yeah.
Oh, okay. And what kind of part did you have in there?
Well, it's a little girl with a kilt who comes out, and they're producing a show, and she sings a swing version of Loch Lomond.
I should have guessed that, shouldn't I?
Yes.
Singer Annie Ross recorded in 1990. Our Jazz Week concludes tomorrow. Coming up, critic Maureen Corrigan picks the best books of the year. This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan goes around the world in less than 80 days in her year-end wrap-up.
My best books list of the year 2000 rises in the Far East and slowly tracks its way westward. British writer Kazuo Ishiguro's novel When We Were Orphans dazzled me with its deft homage to the Golden Age British mystery, as well as its fluid transitions between realistic and hallucinatory styles. Set chiefly in Shanghai during a period stretching from the early decades of the 20th century through World War II, When We Were Orphans recreates the riotous swirl of cultures that once characterized this most noirish of Chinese cities. Loss and regret are Ishiguro's signature themes. In The Remains of the Day, he ruminated on the folly of one man's lifelong emotional restraint. In When We Were Orphans, his hero holds nothing back and still loses all. Contemporary Shanghai is the setting for Xu Shouliang's superb mystery, Death of a Red Heroine. Shouliang was born in that city, became a poet and translator, and is now a professor of Chinese literature at Washington University. His hero, Chief Inspector Shen Kao of the Shanghai Police Bureau, is also a poet in his spare time, and what's more risky in contemporary China, a believer in poetic justice. When the corpse of a strangled woman turns out to be that of a celebrated model worker, whose personal life, Kao discovers, was far from exemplary, Kao bucks communist cadre opposition to crack the case. What's so brilliant about this novel, besides its hard-boiled, intricate plot and subtle characterizations, is its vivid picture of China in the 1990s on the verge of an historic shift into capitalism. Entrepreneurs, Kao observes, were springing up like bamboo shoots after a spring rain. Death of a Red Heroine may only be a humble detective novel, in contrast to the many histories, autobiographies, and works of fiction that have been published in recent years about China. But it does what detective fiction often can do best. It captures the details, the grit of everyday life. As Chief Inspector Kao learns, sometimes you can't think in categories. Sometimes even the lowly oyster of genre fiction produces a matchless pearl. We'll have to pick up the pace here as we move westward. the Everyman's edition of The Complete Stories of Evelyn Waugh reclaims 38 of his stories. Lots of wonderful, long-out-of-print pieces, as well as some of Waugh's juvenilia and satirical cartoons. All are awash in pink gin and Waugh's inimitable wit. Several Deceptions, by contemporary British writer Jane Stevenson, is the kind of clever, atmospheric book I'm always wishing were waiting for me on the table beside my lazy boy at home. Each of the four novellas that makes up this paperback collection ends in an O. Henry-ish surprise, an unforeseen narrative pop that leaves a reader feeling simultaneously giddy and doltish. Let's cross the big puddle now and take a look at The Little Locksmith by New Englander Catherine Butler Hathaway. The Little Locksmith, which was republished this year by the Feminist Press, may just well be the strangest memoir I've ever read. Hathaway was born in 1890 to a well-to-do family, contracted spinal tuberculosis when she was 5, and spent the next decade strapped down on a hard bed, her head encased in a leather halter attached to an iron weight. Her affliction alone, however, is not what makes her memoir so remarkable. Rather, it's her lyrical, yet frank, erotic sensibilities. Hathaway is a polymorphously perverse writer. Practically everything and everyone she describes arouses her and her reader. This circular list began in the East with a book with orphans in its title, and so it sets in the Far West with another book about orphans. Linda Gordon's The Great Arizona Orphan Abduction is a spellbinding narrative history, the kind of rigorous yet vastly readable work that other academics only dream of writing. Deservedly, it won this year's prestigious Bancroft Prize for historical writing. Gordon unearths a long-forgotten story about abandoned Irish Catholic children in turn-of-the-century New York who were sent out to Arizona to be adopted by good Catholic families. The hitch was that those families turned out to be dark-skinned Mexicans. What ensued was a custody battle that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The astonishing story Gordon recovers engages big, vexed intellectual questions about race, class, and gender in a dramatic, accessible fashion. Gordon also treats readers to a gripping but unsentimental tale about daring public assertions of female authority and the force of female desire. In the tradition of the finest historians, Gordon makes us appreciate how very complex the truth of the past and its cast of characters really is.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer was Bob Purdick. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Nonesuch Records, featuring Red Dirt Girl, the new album by Emmylou Harris, available in record stores. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Everyday Genius by Michael J. Gelb, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jazz Week concludes with interviews with drummer Elvin Jones, vibraphonist Gary Burton, and the late trumpeter Lester Bowie. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.